Thank you for joining us today. I will now turn the call over to Carol Iannou.
Good afternoon, and welcome to BNA's audio conference entitled Lessons Learned from Record Management Pioneers. My name is Carol Iannou, and I'm the managing editor of BNA's Digital Discovery and Electronic Evidence Report. This comprehensive publication and website will keep you up to date on the latest trends and cases in e-discovery. If you're not already a subscriber, I invite you to visit ddee.bna.com to learn more and sign up for our free weekly email alert. Before we begin, I have two brief housekeeping matters to take care of. First, if you are interested in receiving CLE credit for this program, you must visit the website attend.bna.com beginning on this Friday to complete the online CLE registration form. Number two, we will have a question and answer session at the end of the program. If you would like to email a question for consideration by our esteemed panel today, please send it to patreardon@bna.com. His email address is preardon@bna.com. Now I would like to turn the program over to our moderator and program developer, Carl Shinneman of Special Counsel, to introduce our distinguished panel of pioneers. Enjoy the program.
Caught me a mid-sandwich there. But anyway, hi, this is Carl Shinneman, and thank you everyone for joining us for this presentation on Pioneer's tips on e-discovery and records management. After I introduce the panel and go through a little housekeeping, we're going to break the material down into four sections, each about a half an hour. The first is an overview of e-discovery issues today. The second are trends in electronic records management. The third is really focusing on what this group as pioneers, what some of their macro lessons learned are. The fourth section is what I call the scary dream segment, where we talk about some of the critical future issues within the field. And then the last half an hour is an audience Q&A section. Anyone in the room listening, if you were the group of people, if you have a BlackBerry, it's okay. You can use your BlackBerry. Just let everyone else know that you have a BlackBerry, and feel free to compile the questions and that people have and email them to me, or email them to preardon@bna.com. Okay, now I want to introduce the panelists. The first panelist is on his way here en route, but he'll be on shortly, Jonathan Redgrave. He's one of the real pioneers in the field from the law firm side. And with several other lawyers from large firms, they banded together and created the only national virtual law firm devoted to this field. He's also been instrumental in the Sedona Conference's creation and growth and speaks at many of the significant e-discovery or regional or electronic records management programs in the country. And if you Google Jonathan Redgrave, you'd have to be prepared to spend a day reading all the things he's done in the e-discovery world. The second speaker is Neil Rubin, who was the first attorney I saw speak on developing systems and actively managing corporate electronic information. I saw him at a conference in New York 3 years before the federal rules went into effect, and I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. He has great benchmarking data, he's a true vision on how to start attacking this area, and is a very engaging speaker, and I'm thrilled to have him on the panel. He's a true pioneer. Joe Kasouf is from Nationwide Insurance. Joe and I have presented a few times at eDiscovery conferences, and together we overwhelmed the group of insurance lawyers at the end of 2004 with the only segment on a two-day conference on eDiscovery. Joe individually spearheaded the effort to take control of eDiscovery in-house at Nationwide Insurance. He developed a number of metrics to show his company why this was working, or put another way, how much money they were saving. He also coined or branded the eDiscovery term of art, the money dance, which is something you might go into at some point. Fourth speaker is the only non-lawyer on the panel, Cliff Ovadia. Cliff is involved in many of IBM's most technologically challenging projects. He works on Fortune 100 technology and records management projects across the country. He brings the experience of building systems at large companies and a sense of what works and doesn't work from a business and technical standpoint. Stephanie Mendelson is from Genentech. She's the director of corporate records and e-discovery at Genentech. She reports to the director of litigation. I met Stephanie by staffing a national project with her in Pittsburgh for her former law firm, Reed Smith. She gained a reputation at that firm as one of their top e-discovery lawyers. And in her role at Genentech's legal department, Stephanie's responsible for developing and implementing strategies related to the management of corporate records from creation through disposition. The last panelist is Michael Scott from Alcoa. Mike's a former high-tech lawyer from California who, through acquisition a number of years ago, came to Pittsburgh to work at Alcoa. Mike and I, in 2003, worked on a pioneer project involving knowledge managing electronic records. He's as tech-savvy as any lawyer I've ever met. He even gave a CLE in mid-2005 on how to use GPS tools and iPods in the practice of law. He manages e-discovery litigation matters at Alcoa and is considered the lawyer at Alcoa who should be contacted whenever there are messy technology and legal issues floating around. My name's Carl Shinneman. I'm a vice president of special counsel. I'm sort of an MBA entrepreneur lawyer. And the way I've sort of position myself in this sort of messy area is I'm really a neutral in the world of e-discovery. I consider these programs to be sort of the NPR of e-discovery. I don't really care what direction the answers go in. I just know I don't really have strong biases either way, and I like to bring together panels of experts and see if we can come up with some good guidance here. And that's basically what we try to do. So I hope you enjoy it. So let's start off here. By now, everyone's familiar with the new federal rules going into effect on December 1st, 2006, and I'm presuming everyone here has heard about them. I thought we'd get a few minutes to go over a few of the more important areas within that have been developing over the last few months in these areas. The first question I wanted to direct is to Stephanie Mendelson, and tell me a little bit about the meet and confer process. Rule 26F basically says that parties must meet early in the process to discuss these discovery questions and what are called meet and confers. How does an effective electronic records management system help to accomplish this?
Well, Carl, the first thing I think it's important to kind of just review is what a party has to be ready to discuss in the meet and confer. And we get our source for that from Rule 26F, from the committee notes, and also we get some information from the Manual for Complex Litigation 4th. If you look at what the parties have to be prepared in the meet and confer to discuss, I think the first kind of standard to remember is that that it's always case specific. So there's not going to be necessarily a set list of things that have to be discussed in every case. But you have to be ready to discuss information systems, according to the committee note, who in your company has special knowledge of those systems, different sources of data that contain potentially relevant information, and then whether the information is reasonably accessible. Rule 26 specifically says that you need to be ready to discuss generally any issues relating to the disclosure or discovery of ESI, including how you're going to produce it, privilege issues, and any limitations on discovery. I mentioned the Manual for Complex Litigation, and though it's not, it's our most current version right now, and what the manual talks about is whether preservation will require you to suspend routine processes. Also, the manual talks about how you're going to preserve what they describe as volatile material, voicemail, databases, email. So those sources of information give us a guideline of information that you have to be prepared to talk about. When you look at a record management program, fundamentally, we're trying to help make sure that records are kept as long as we need to make sure we meet business requirements, legal and regulatory requirements, and that records beyond their useful life are disposed. When corporations have such a significant portion of records being ESI, you simply can't manage them through their life cycle without being familiar with the information systems that they're contained in and with some of the issues that that I talked about as things that you have to be prepared to talk about. So getting your records management program developed
and implemented will help you and actually require you to know where your records are, who owns the records, things like when ESI is backed up and when it's overwritten. So really the whole process of developing, implementing, even monitoring for compliance, a records management program, provides the very information that you need to prepare for the meet and confer.
Okay. Joe Kasouf, I read an article recently about how saving documents or marking documents as work product or privileged documents can inadvertently set the clock to that date for when companies should have started their preservation of electronic records in anticipation of litigation. So if you overuse privilege, your privilege logs can create the battleground on when you should have started preserving documents. What's your reaction to this issue, and how do you protect yourself if a junior associate or contract attorney makes a privilege call during litigation and you didn't start your preservation until months later?
Well, the first issue is sometimes you welcome the battleground, and it's not a bad place to be. Oftentimes, you know, we get these documents, or as attorneys, we put privilege on everything, depending on who you're dealing with. In our environment, most of what we are dealing with, we create an opinion and we create a legal environment, so we have to have that privilege. But as counsel, you have to begin to communicate with your clients. You cannot always be sure that an issue of litigation is what's pending. And that's what I look for in the duty to preserve, and what's the triggers, the foreseeability of litigation. If we can determine in these initial discussions or communication that there's a high degree of certainty of litigation, then we need to take every step to preserve documents and the flow of documents and communication right from that date. And we'd be remiss if we failed to do that, thinking that we could argue this later. So I think you have to be aware, look at what you're doing, and make sure that if there's foreseeability of litigation, you're addressing it. If you cannot, you know, determine it's foreseeable, I still would maintain a privilege, because you know, you don't know what's coming down the pipe, and I would feel safer having that information privileged as much as I can maintain the privilege when challenged. When you have the situation where you've got your attorneys marking things privileged prior to a date that you did that, well, part of that becomes, training and making sure you've established a privilege for a sound reason, making sure you did this in advance and you know. A lot of the records management and best practices that we put into place here strive for that. Make sure you are doing things in such a mindset that if we need to produce and get this information later, we can account for what privileges we've claimed. You don't know that always from the beginning, but you have a pretty good idea. And I think, you know, this is important for counsel in advising your clients of how to do this so that you don't get caught later. Having a preservation process in place, knowing from day one what you're going to do, is essential. So communicate soundly and train so people understand when and how to use those privileges.
There's a good article attached in the materials about this issue, and I've pulled a lot of the material from BNA's publication to highlight some of these issues. So let's talk a little bit about litigation holds and preservation orders. This is for you, Neil. There have been a number of high-profile cases and settlements involving companies who were unable to successfully preserve emails at the onset of litigation. Morgan Stanley's issues in this area have been well covered. I also read about a case that didn't get talked a lot about, but I read in a magazine about a $60 million IP settlement involving Microsoft with Burst.com. In the mid-2006, where there were gaps in emails produced, some commentators suggested it led to the settlement on the eve of trial. Lately, the big case everyone seems to be focused on is the Intel matter with their high-profile dispute with AMD, and backup tapes might help to resolve the faulty preservation or possibly faulty preservation efforts. But it seems to me that this problem of not preserving emails and other electronic records is going to be occurring more frequently than they occurred back when paper ruled the day for discovery. Because with paper, there wasn't as big of an emphasis on getting rid of records as quickly, like within 30 days, which is how some email policies are written. you know, litigants would just go to a warehouse and get the boxes, and whatever you found was what was produced. So with that background in mind, Neil, do you agree there's more pressure being put on large companies to tighten up their preservation and litigation hold processes? And can they really accomplish this given their size and multiple people who have to be on the same page?
Well, I do think there's probably greater expectation that big companies will do it, in part because it's doable today, and perhaps greater penalties for non-compliance. But I think that, you know, most big companies have built in a system where they can electronically do litigation holds, and our company is no different. And when we get a new matter or a new threatened matter, and we identify people who are likely to have relevant information, we certainly send out a preservation notice, and it's really a click accept model, so that if you're sending it out to 50 or 500 people, you want to make sure that everyone has acknowledged this and complied with it and recognizes the penalties for non-compliance. So I think that you know, it is doable, because you can sort of automate the process a little bit. But I think the goal here is, you know, for me, I would say the goal is not perfect can't be the enemy of good. And so when I'm thinking about a process for litigation holds and preservation notices, again, I want to be able to go into court and say, and be able to defend it and say, we have a good process, we followed it here, and this is, you know, why we do it, and this is how we do it. I think the hardest part about, for me, for litigation holds and preservation orders is the tension between, you know, telling people to preserve data and hold on to data until told otherwise. That's the easy part. But in most cases, you know, you might have 5 or 10 key witnesses where you want to get their data, process it, and look at it. But you may have, you know, a much larger number of sort of secondary people who may or may not have information, but in abundance of caution, you're telling them, well, hold on to everything. But it's very costly, of course, to then go process that data and have lawyers look through it. And so I think one of the harder issues on litigation holds is it's easy to send out the notice. The question is, you know, can you trust that secondary group of people to preserve data, or do you actually want to go about actually getting their data, mining it, and looking at it? And the question is, you know, what's cost justified in any particular case? And I find that to be the hard part. The easy part about automating a litigation hold, I think we're doing pretty well. I think most big companies are doing pretty well.
It's a good setup for the next question. This is for Stephanie. High-profile spoliation cases have e-discovery partners aware of the risks over losing data. I'd like you to consider, and this, by the way, is the longest question of the day. I'm going to read a couple facts here. I'd like you to consider an excerpt from a really vivid newspaper article in the San Jose Mercury News from April 25th, 2007, called Intel Filing Details Errors Resulting in Lost Emails, which describes the issues Intel has faced in their litigation with AMD, where they've allegedly lost emails from 378 employees through human error, were not told for 8 months of the litigation hold, despite Intel's Herculean efforts to gather and preserve electronic data. And bear in mind, this all came off a filing, so it's one-sided, and it's a newspaper article. But the article says that Intel's latest filing, based on an internal investigation, provides the most comprehensive account thus far of a complex multi-million-dollar electronic discovery process that spans 6 continents and has already produced 17 million documents. Both companies expect it to be the largest collection of electronic documents in legal history. Last year, a representative for AMD told the court that the company initially expected to receive electronic documents that, if printed on standard paper and stacked, would reach 137 miles high. Just to retrieve one type of data backup file, Intel said in Monday's report, it had to send 50 paralegals to 16 countries from Brazil to China. The company said the discovery task was of such a magnitude that it probably never could have been accomplished without some lapses. Given the enormity of the task, they are not surprised mistakes would be made. I personally understand this now. In February, I lost 5,200 iTunes songs from my home software, and now I personally can understand this. Another example, Ken Thibodeau, head of the National Archives Electronic Records Archive, said that electronic records are being sent to the archives at 100 times the rate of paper records. And his observation is, we don't know how to prevent the loss of most digital information that's being created today. So now the question, with these experiences in mind, is the bar too high to expect perfection in preserving and producing relevant electronic documents with a volume of data that must be preserved and possibly produced? And if so, can judges and plaintiffs be educated on the problem of inadvertently losing electronic data?
So, I think the first part of your question is the bar too high in expecting perfection? And I don't think the courts expect perfection. I don't think opposing parties, but I think expect it as well. But I think we have a lot of education to do, as the second part of your question contemplates. I think the Intel example really reflects the just tremendous effort that companies are going to try and meet their obligations. I don't think it's uncommon for you know, multinational parties to be, you know, sending teams and teams of people around the world to make sure that that data is preserved appropriately and collected. And so, you know, I think that's the baseline. Everybody, I think, for the most part, is really trying to do the right thing. But Neil really hit it on the head that perfection here can be the enemy of good. And the Intel example really kind of shows the complexity and the risk associated with e-discovery. I read a quote recently that, or some statistics recently that showed the volume of ESI in large corporations today easily exceeds the volume of data in the Library of Congress if it were digitized. I mean, people are dealing with just massive, massive amounts of data. And I think beyond the difficulty of finding relevant ESI and collecting it and processing it and reviewing it, one of the biggest challenges is the fact that so many still underestimate the complexity of e-discovery. And the fact is that no collection of ESI is going to be complete. I think the amended rules acknowledge this fact that perfection isn't the goal. In connection with preservation, the committee notes state that the goal of the meet and confer is agreeing on reasonable preservation steps. And the committee notes also pick up on a theme that we saw from Judge Shinlin in Zubu Lake, that preservation should balance the competing needs to preserve relevant evidence and to continue routine operations. The committee notes recognize that broad cessation of a party's routine operations could paralyze a party's activity. And so I think, yes, that judges and plaintiffs can be educated, and that experience and case law are going to hopefully begin to reflect the reasonableness standard that's incorporated into the amended rules and not some kind of unattainable goal of perfection.
Mike, I'm going to have you weigh in a little bit on this. One of the rules, 37F, addresses the loss of evidence through routine email purging. How does having an electronic record management system help if you can't get it to stop on a dime from deleting records? Or if you have a move-it-or-lose-it system like Intel had, or if you didn't move your email, no file, it was going to disappear. You're faced with litigation, and you're automatically deleting records despite the onset of litigation.
Well, we're talking about continually good faith, and people have talked about 37F as a safe harbor in that it says situations when sanctions, as Zuba Lake and all these Morgan Stanley and all these others have been imposed, in the context of routine good faith operations of an electronic information system, but really there are a number of key elements there. One, good faith. To routine, and the notes go really very, very carefully in talking about that routine operation of a information system may include, and then actually probably does include, processes that will stop various things, routine cleansing and mailbox management. Good faith really, to me, implies a process. And as you go into it, and we've talked about that we're not seeking perfection, but we're seeking something that's solid, that it is documented, that I think to the context and people who are subject to the SOX requirements or understand the concepts of risk assessment and assessing various risk areas is probably very important whether or not your client or company is in fact subject to SOX, but all these things go into being able to say, Your Honor, opposing parties, we have a system. We utilize it. It didn't stop on a dime, but it certainly, this is how we went about doing it. This is our process. This, we did follow our process. So this is not something that you should look at for giving sanctions. Now, P.S., as you go through this, and another thing that people note when they point out this is not an overriding safe harbor, it talks about sanctions under these rules. Even the notes go to say that a magistrate judge or a district judge or when things are applicable to state court have lots of ways to impose sanctions outside of the rules of civil procedure if they want to. But document, good faith, follow your process.
Okay, this is the next question is for Cliff, the non-lawyer in the group. It's more of a technology question. I was reading the May-June 2007 issue of AAIMZ Doc Magazine. That stands for the Association for Information and Image Management, and there are a 70,000-person group of technology vendors, technology personnel, and technology users, among others. And in this issue, John Mancini, who's the president of AAIM, states that their surveys show that a problem exists with basic effective information management when 33% of the participating organizations give a poor rating to their information management practices, and the average survey result from their own organizations was a 5.43 on a 10-point scale, so it's pretty neutral. Mancini goes on to say, quote, this rather bleak self-appraisal combined with cascading compliance concerns, and at least in the U.S., a growing concern about the ability to meet new federal e-discovery requirements, illustrate a significant change in the core business drivers from the early years of the survey. And they're mostly to risk-based drivers. Cliff, do you agree that information management for e-discovery purposes is really that bleak, or just information management in general?
Thanks, Carl. I guess I would say that bleak is probably a strong term, but it's certainly an area that has been deferred, underfunded, and in some cases ignored within a lot of organizations. Records management, the topic, has been sort of the third rail where every company knows that it's an important piece of their operation, but again, it's not a competitive advantage necessarily, and until recent visibility and some obvious business drivers from a compliance and regulatory standpoint and some of these rather eye-catching judgments, have companies really looked in and said, okay, now we've said that we're committed to records management, where are we really? Within a lot of companies, there are a lot of folks who are really afraid by asking that question whether or not they're somehow going to end up owning the realities of how tangled this is. So there is a significant challenge from the historical buildup of information. Until recently, it was cheaper to hang on to paper than it was to save data. With the tools that are available today to create this proliferation, we're certainly all aware of that. But there's also a people side. The need for people to understand how to use record management systems, what is a document that needs to be declared as a valid record, if they care enough and they know enough, are they consistently interpreting which retention rule to map? So a lot of this is, it is a very big space, and companies have been struggling. A lot of the funding for these kinds of things have come from the business operations side, where this has been less of a priority to do with the same level of, expectation that's been established now when this is becoming more of a regulatory and legal perspective.
Neil, I'd like to ask you from a legal perspective, how do you react as a lawyer when you hear a group of combined IT people saying they're not in very good shape for the rigors of e-discovery?
Well, I guess a couple points. Number one is that you need some support, as I think the other person was just mentioning, from senior management in the company to make this a priority, whether it's to find funding for it or make sure that people are complying with the requirements that the legal department puts out there. But, it's a cultural issue at the company, and the larger the company is, the harder it is to get everyone rowing together. So you need a certain amount of senior management statements to say this is part of the ongoing maturation of the company, we're committed to this, as a result we're providing training or we're asking people to read the following documents, to click accept them, to show that they're on board, etc. So I don't think the legal department can, you know, can necessarily get to full compliance. It's kind of leading with your chin sometimes to be in-house counsel and say, we have to do this, you know, for the legal risks. It's always easier to say, no, this is good business for the company. On the issue of whether things are bleak on the IT side of it, I would separate two issues. One that we were talking about before is what happens if a company, you know, either inadvertently or deliberately deletes information, and then that turns out that would have been relevant. The larger, and that's going to happen from time to time, and if you have a process that says we delete data every X number of years, months, whatever it is, and you don't follow it perfectly, there's sometimes you need to explain that. For me right now, the more difficult issue is finding something that you probably still have, and just the whole process of enterprise search. And I know that there's a fair amount of venture capital money going into the market for enterprise searching. You know, Google owns the consumer space, but in terms of big companies being able to find the data that they have, there's a fair amount of investment that's going there. If it's bleak today, I think it's going to be a whole lot better in 3 or 5 years as companies invest in trying to be able to manage data and find it more quickly. And I think it's particularly important in legal departments because Rule 26 does a reasonably good job, as Stephanie was saying, of telling the parties what they need to produce, but you usually have 30, 60, 90, may even be longer, depending on if you're going to go into some sort of ADR at the beginning, to get your data. And so, you know, it's not a huge sprint at the beginning. But sometimes you're responding to whether it's a government inquiry or an ethics allegation or some, just internal matter where you need to figure out what happened today, you know, yesterday. And you don't need – the 80-20 rule applies. You don't need to know every single fact immediately, but it's kind of like you're on the gun, what happened here? And that, to me, it's not about, oh, did we delete something? It's just how do we find it, and how do we find it quickly? And I think the answer to that question, there's a lot of money going in to help big companies answer that question. And so, you know, we're not there yet, but I suspect that things are getting better, not worse.
Now let's talk about the granddaddy of e-discovery cases, which was reversed on March 26. And all I can say is thank God Zubelake is good law. I'd have to change the name of my e-discovery wine, 4C, which is based loosely on that opinion. But anyway, and I actually do have some wine, but that's a whole other – that's for live presentations. Anyway, let's talk about the reversal Morgan Stanley decision. Joe Kasuf, I used to say there were 1.5 billion reasons to get serious about e-discovery. Now, with the reversal of the $1.5 billion award, is e-discovery just another area of law akin to, say, workers' compensation law?
I don't think so. I hope not. I think the Morgan Stanley decision shouldn't change anyone's mind about the dangers of properly handling data requests and all of the e-discovery issues that we face. I think, as Neil just mentioned, just having to find all this stuff and all the money and effort that's put into locating information is really important. What I think that it says is that you have to do things right or the potential for these verdicts is still going to be there. One of the people quoted in the article, Thomas Bennett, had said that the sheer size of the original Morgan Stanley Award has influenced the field already. And I think that's really important and true. The fact that that's out there is what's going to drive much of what we do. So I think this was the case was really a reversal on evidentiary grounds rather than e-discovery. And I think the courts are going to continue to hold, and even more so with the new rules, law firms responsible for managing e-discovery and reporting accurately on the status of their work. Much of that, as you go through the trial court's comments, things such as wrongful conduct has continued to and unabated, and discovery abuses outlined call into doubt Morgan Stanley's discovery responses. These types of things are what you really have to watch out for, and the fact that this was reduced is going to change, I think, how we as corporations work through our data and work with our associates, et cetera. It indicates that those responsible for e-discovery, whether it's the company, the law firm, vendors, whoever's managing this process, really has to adhere to rules and be responsible for the work that they put out. This failure to properly manage is just going to end up, I think, in another similar verdict, if not just playing up on what was done in this case. It's far from a workers' comp type situation or any run-of-the-mill type of work. And I think it really comes down to that e-discovery changes so rapidly, in my experience over these few years, that you don't know what the next day is going to bring, with whether it be technology or what's going on with a rule. But we, as the attorneys, the vendors, et cetera, you got to be held responsible for what we do. And I think that's really what you have to take away from this. Make sure you do things right, have a plan in place, know what your limitations are, know where to go to get the right people, and be sure that you're following your own rules.
Stephanie, I read an article recently on how Oracle CEO Ellison has been interviewed for a book, and apparently there was a digital audio tape that was involved that's now missing, and there's litigation, and they're trying to find this. Do you lock down all the information key executives can touch for fear of future litigation? I mean, do you have to really counsel them on what they can and can't do today?
I think it's so important that business needs not be accommodated for litigation until there's a litigation obligation, such as the duty to preserve. That doesn't mean we, you know, walk around with blinders to what's going on in connection with e-discovery and our other litigation obligations. But if you're operating as a good business should, and you're meeting your legal and regulatory requirements and you're satisfying your business needs, then a corporation shouldn't have to modify its record-keeping practices to accommodate litigation. The Oracle example raises issues for me that are similar to issues raised by unified messaging. I've seen that many companies are moving to unified messaging systems for their voicemail, where the voicemail messages are digitized and then can be managed similar to email, and they can be retrieved and forwarded and even archived like email. And I think that the way to reduce risk related to digital audio, like what we see with unified messaging, is really education and supported by some policy. So I think you remind users in the context of digital audio that, for example, voicemail is not a conversation, but really shouldn't be longer than, you know, the kind of message we would have formerly included on the pink message pads we used to use. You know, those ones that we would stick on our desk with the, you know, on the sharp pointy holder thing. And you educate users that with the World Wide Web, voicemails can be distributed around the world without their knowledge. And then you support that effort, education effort, with policy that can reduce your risk by addressing issues such as how long messages are retained, whether disaster recovery tapes are made, et cetera. So, Carl, I think that's how you address some of those issues.
Okay.
Hey, Carl, this is Neil Rubin. Can I actually speak to that for a second, too, since since Cisco is the primary manufacturer of a lot of these voicemail systems, so I assume lawyers all over the world are taking our name in vain. But the voicemail is obviously a very interesting issue here, but it's funny, when we rolled out unified messaging over the last couple of years, I've gotten a number of phone calls from and it depends who your customers are. Law firms tend to love this stuff. They feel like all their communications privileged, and they don't have Sarbanes-Oxley requirements because they're not publicly traded, et cetera. So if your customer is a smaller company, but some big companies, heads of litigation have called me and they say, this is a disaster and I hate this feature. And I think they expect me to say, as the, you know, the Cisco person, no, it's great for the following reasons. And I say, yeah, don't you just hate it? I hate it too. So, but usually functionality like that can be disabled on various products. And I can tell you that Cisco takes the position that, you know, voicemail, we're going to retain voicemail for 30 days. And we tell people we've disabled the functionality that allows people to take voicemail messages and put them into a WAV file and attach them to email and send them because, as Stephanie said, they would go outside the company. That which is one problem. And can you imagine how much time your outside lawyers would take if they had to go through every one of these voicemails that was saved to a WAV file? I mean, at least you can do word searches with email and in a cost-effective way find the relevant email, but you can't do that, at least not yet, with voicemail messages. So, you know, my view has been, and this goes back to the point I was making where I don't think courts are trying to rewrite companies' data management, records management process. You know, we could have put a tape recorder next to the telephone for the last 75 years and recorded all of our voicemail messages too, but it wasn't a good idea then. And the fact that technologically we can attach WAV files doesn't mean that, you know, you have to do it. It's a business decision, and if the advantages to the business of having that kind of accessibility to voicemail outweigh these risks, then that's great. That's a smart decision for some companies. Some companies are going to say, no, there are too many of us, and we're going to end up airing a lot of dirty laundry outside the company, because people are not educable as it relates to voicemail.
you know, it's a tough call, but you can make it either way, I guess, is my point, and either way I think is entirely defensible in court.
Jonathan Redgrave, at the Georgetown conference you hosted last year, you described Rule 26b-2 as a speed bump rule, which basically provides guidelines on when costs or inaccessibility can be used to justify not producing an electronic document. Why is it a speed bump, and how does records management process help with this call? Do you have any updates in this area also?
Carl, thanks very much. The Rule 26b-2, there's two different provisions here that are important. One has been here for a long time. It's just been renumbered, and that's 26b-2c. 26b-2b deals with the not reasonably accessible language of the new rule that came into effect December 1, 2006. What's important about both of these rules is to realize, as you noted from last year when I called them a speed bump, that they really are designed as ways in which to limit discovery and limit it in terms of marginal utility. And that's really what underlies a lot of what's in 26b-2c. And that's really what you've heard everyone talking about in many ways on the call to this point, that there have to be limits, and where do we draw those bounds, whether it's voicemail, whether it's WAV files or voicemails reduced to that or anything else. And when we're in discovery and talking about 26b-2, we're really looking at the post-preservation stage, of course, and that's a different issue. But when we're talking about what do you actually have to produce, there are specific speed bumps that should cause us pause. The first one that came into effect with the new rules that has caused a lot of consternation is, what do we do with information that's not reasonably accessible? And remember, when you're looking at these issues and cases, the important addition that the Rules Committee added was not reasonably accessible because of undue burden or cost. This isn't a technological answer. It is one that's focused on the true burden or cost. And as a practice pointer, what people need to understand, and this is what we're seeing in the case law, is people having various degrees of success. What they need to understand is the way in which you're going to explain this undue burden and cost to a court. Is it really unduly burdensome to spend an extra $100? Is it $1,000? When you're looking at a corporation, it's a multi-billion-dollar corporation. Where is it that it's an undue burden or cost? And what's critical about that analysis, and where we're seeing people not really paying attention to the ball, is the fact that they just look at the numbers and they're saying, well, it's unduly burdensome. Where we've seen success is where people say, aha, this is also tied to that key concept of relevance, because we're talking about marginal relevance. The marginal utility test looks at how important is it to get to this information. And if you look at some of the cases where people are making these arguments, where courts are listening and understanding, it's when you say, we could go there, but this information is most likely to become or is duplicative. It is a source that may have some odds and ends that weren't in the email collection that we took from the servers. But you know what? The chance of it being there is so low. The seminal cases of McPeak versus Ashcroft, the two decisions from Magistrate Judge Fagiola, were really a foreshadowing of what this rule can do. And there, the Department of Justice had very good briefing and very good declarations and affidavits about what was likely to be found, how much it would cost, and ultimately that prevailed on saying that the party didn't have to go any further. So in terms of what we're beginning to see is a lot of briefing out there, and surprise, surprise, not many cases so far have been citing 26B2B or B2B in terms of the not reasonably accessible, because it hasn't gone through all the briefing yet. But what we're seeing in terms of the background, if you're paying attention and you're aware of some of these cases, you're seeing that the people that are having success are those people that are able to express the cost and burden very clearly, but then tie it to the relevance and explain why it's marginal relevance.
Okay. I'll give you one other technical question, Jonathan. There's been a lot written over the past year about the uncertainty dealing with inadvertent disclosure of privileged documents. Currently, proposed Rule 502 is accepting comments. What's the lay of the land right now on privilege and inadvertent productions?
Well, two things. First of all, the Advisory Committee on Evidence Rules, on May 15th, they issued this report to a standing committee with respect to what happened at the April 2007 meeting. And that meeting really was the Rules Committee chance to take a look at what all the public comments were that came in by the deadline of February 1st. And as a result, they have now made a number of changes to proposed Rule 502 that had been issued for public comment. And I'll quickly just go through those. First, changes were made by the Style Subcommittee of the Standing Committee and that's a lot of words there, but basically the style rules are coming out at the end of this year, which are going to change some of the nomenclature and some of the way the words appear in the rules. They're not meant to really change the rules themselves, but these rules were able to be roughed up against that process, and therefore that was done. The text was also clarified to indicate that the protections of Rule 502 apply in all cases in federal court, including cases in which the state law is providing the rule of decision in the federal court, because there was an apparent loophole there that was brought out in the comments. The text was also clarified to stress that Rule 502 would apply in state court with respect to consequences of disclosure previously made at the federal level, and that was in respect to Rules 101 and 1101. There was some concern that those might trump. The text was clarified to say, no, they do not. Language was also added by the committee to emphasize that subject matter waiver cannot be found unless the waiver is intentional. So an inadvertent disclosure can never constitute subject matter waiver. That's one of the big things about the rule, and it was the language was revisited to emphasize that. The committee also changed the language to relax the requirements necessary to obtain protection against waiver from inadvertent disclosure. The protections against waiver by mistaken disclosure were also extended to disclosures made to federal offices or agencies on the ground that production in that context may involve or can involve the same costs of pre-production privilege review as litigation. Now, the next one is an important one for people that like listening about selective waiver arguments, and that was the selective waiver provision, on which the Evidence Committee, by the way, had never affirmatively voted. It was just put into the proposed rule for comment. That was dropped by the committee. So there is no selective waiver provision in the rule that is going forward from this point. The committee also deleted language conditioning enforceability of federal court confidentiality orders on agreement of the parties, concluding that a federal order finding that disclosure is not a waiver should be enforceable in any proceeding regardless of party agreement. And then the final thing that was done in the changes in April that have now come out in May is the definition of work product was expanded to include intangible information, as the work product protection under federal common law, of course, extends to all materials prepared in anticipation of litigation, including intangibles. So that's really what happened in the last month or so with respect to these rules. In practice, of course, these rules are still proposed rules. We know that Judge Grimm cited them in the Hobson opinion. We think that other courts will likely cite them before they go into effect. But, of course, they're not in effect yet. The next meeting of the Standing Rules Committee is in June 2007, at which time further action may be expected on Rule 502. In the meantime, we know that there are still arguments and cases going on out there where people are arguing that the failure to review all of your electronically stored information for privilege may be a waiver. People are saying there's no way they're ever going to enter into these quick peek agreements where you produce information without reviewing it somehow for privilege. And quite frankly, there is no, and the reason why Rule 502 is getting the traction it is there is no good answer out there, and it really depends on the jurisdiction you're in. So that's really the update on Rule 502, Carl.
Okay, now let's go into electronic records management. I'd like to spend some time talking about some of the surveys I've been reading in this area. There's still so many surveys out there which say how far corporate America has to go to get prepared in the e-discovery field and the related field of electronic records management. The last event I hosted in February, I talked a lot about Gartner Group, LexisNexis, and Computer World. I've been focusing on this presentation on the AAIM survey, which came out recently. And, Neil, the AAIM Industry Watch survey showed a drop in confidence in the ability to produce information that's accurate, accessible, and trustworthy, which is a basic requirement of any records management strategy. They said the user confidence has dropped from 63% in 2006 to 54% in 2007. Are we heading in the wrong direction or just beginning to understand how complicated this area is?
Well, I don't know that we're heading in the wrong direction. I mean, I would say mostly it's complicated because, you know, if you think about the amount of data that's being retained by corporate, entities, it's expanding, you know, sort of exponentially. So I'm not surprised that the number is going down because, you know, the haystacks are getting much, much bigger and more numerous. So finding every needle is a harder job today than it was, you know, just a few years ago. And the amount of data being stored by big companies is expanding quickly. So, you know, but I'm less concerned with, you know, what the industry survey shows, and more concerned with, you know, what judges are going to think about this and think about, you know, whether the company's processes are appropriate. I mean, this really goes to the question I think that was asked of Stephanie, is how do you go about educating folks and educating the bench on some of this? And every case is different, but, you know, when you go in there saying this is what we did and this is why we did it and this is why it was cost justified in this case, I think, you know, that kind of position is usually a defensible one. And the fact is that, you know, you usually have to look at more databases, and there are more databases to look at. And, you know, we're not in business to win litigation. We're in business to, you know, for other purposes. So we're trying to find cost-effective solutions here. And the explosion of data, I think judges understand that part of it too.
Mike Scott, an interesting aspect of the survey is the drop in confidence is most pronounced among larger companies. There were 64% confidence at smaller companies, 51% at midsize, and 50% among large companies. Yet at every event I attend or speak at, the panelists seem to all be from large companies who are doing the most in this area. You know, what does this mean?
I think it means that people are beginning to realize the size and scope of some of the problems. I think initially people were under the impression that being able to access and get at this information was relatively easy. And now as people get into it, it becomes a question of people not even understanding until they poke at it exactly what systems they have and where all this material happens to be located. I mean, ESI does not mean easily recovered electronically stored information. And one of the benefits, I think, as we get into a number of cases where people have to meet and have the early 26F meet and confer conferences, where you have to disclose your sources of ESI and the places you will be looking and what ESI you consider not readily accessible, will force people to begin to have an appropriate inventory of all these systems. And at some point, I think you're going to see that number begin to go the other way again. But I think right now, it's people are just realizing that it's a much bigger problem than they thought originally.
Stephanie, I'm going to revisit the question Neil referred to a second ago. And one of my past panelists, Jim Mikowitz, has done a bunch of shows with me in the past, often points to these consumer surveys, which show that juries don't believe big companies are being truthful. And his take on this has been that if you mess up your data, there's a real chance that juries will think it's intentional. And when you take this lack of trust and you combine this with what the surveys are showing, that the companies themselves have a lack of confidence in managing their own data, you know, does this mean that companies should be really scared of litigation today? And how do we educate juries and judges that this problem's a real one? Is it briefings? Is it pleadings or, you know, surveys? I mean, what are some good, you know, do you have any ideas on how to do this?
Well, I think, you know, Neil described your jobs to go into court and explain to the court and the opponents the process you followed. You know, whether you do that through briefings, through testimony of your 30B6, you know, I think the main thing is that you have a process, it's documented. The amended rules reflect the opportunity to demonstrate that the corporation acted in good faith. And you just have to plan ahead for how you're going to demonstrate your good faith throughout the various steps, including, you know, preservation, collection, et cetera.
Cliff, now to focus on the building these systems, you helped to build these complex systems that no one has confidence in. And I hate to put you on the spot, not no one, 50%. I hate to put you on the spot, but given the surveys, large companies are still feeling vulnerable in growing numbers. Is the problem that there aren't enough systems being built, or the systems need to improve, or is this still very complicated stuff and there are just going to be leaks of the management of information?
You know, Kyle, I think I think everyone on the call has already touched on aspects of this. The fact that it's historically existed in the domain of operations, the fact that it has been an underfunded area that really a lot of folks just didn't want to take a really close look at. They were hoping it was working, and they were also hoping it was someone else's problem. And only recently have they started to peel that back and understand that there's a lot going on there. There have been a lot of investments made in certain areas, but this is rarely, I can't think of a single example where a company has built out a single central records repository that is all content, all documents, all data, all correspondence for the enterprise. So the reality is you've got a lot of different content types that are being created, whether they be Word documents, email exchanges, instant messages, and that's, you know, what we can come back to that a little later. The kinds of communication capabilities that are being developed, you know, those are changing on an ongoing basis. The places where those would be stored, the ways in which they're stored, the ability to find them, and I think we're going to talk a little later about searching that came up earlier, making sure that you can find some of this data. So there are a lot of different repositories, there are a lot of different actors, there are a lot of different business reasons for these things. And the difficulty a lot of companies are having is they're coming up out of the sand and saying, you know, what do I do with my file room? Where this is an enormous question, as opposed to, you know, trying to think through this and understand how, you know, they could be a little proactive, they could be a little strategic, and I think that's the piece that's really helping the companies that are making progress are understanding how they can take on manageable bites toward an end goal, building off of the platforms they already have in place.
Okay, this is a question I've always wanted to ask you, Mike Scott. Back in 2003, I think we were talking about the tension between organizing data and managing it and the growing cheap supply of storage space and the endless storage ability to put information in sort of the attic. You weren't certain back then what the correct answer was. Do you still see this tension today in 2007, and where do you think the answer lies?
Yes, it's the old Google theory. You save it all, and in the end, when necessary, we can find it. Well, if the goal is only to be able to produce, because you certainly don't have no preservation issues in that case, for litigation, maybe. But an example, I recently attended at a conference where a records manager for Philip Morris International was describing a process that they have instituted as to certain key identified individuals in their company. For them, all emails of any nature whatsoever are preserved indefinitely, forever. It's kind of a save enough bathwater to drown the baby type of theory. I realize that they have certain key issues and repeating issues and lots of litigation. But that's not a record or an information management system process, nor is it really a retention process where you have to understand the purposes that a given record serves for the enterprise and deal with it. You put it in the attic, and you may go after it later, or it may just sit there. Just because the solution is technologically feasible doesn't make it right, and it doesn't really solve, at the end of the day, the business need for the information, not the container, but the information. Regulator tells you to save it. You save it because of litigation, but at the end, you're saving it because it's going to help you and help the enterprise and the institution do something better next time. And so you need to have some thought as to what it is you're saving, why, how you deal with it. Access is only, to me, one part of it. I'm certainly less in favor of the attic system than I was in 1994, but I continue to still see tension and participate in it regularly.
Okay, this is sort of a follow-up to Mike's question, and I asked a similar question at last February's event, but it intrigues me that so many of the surveys out there show lots of inactivity in the e-discovery field. Last fall, AIM released a survey of 1,000 organizations that said most organizations do not have any real plan or strategy when it comes to managing email and instant messages. Joe Kasouf is... Is the majority here smarter to ignore this problem, or is this like not paying your taxes? Sure, you might not get caught right away, but when you do, ouch.
Yeah, it's a big ouch to me. I would think, I'm actually surprised that the majority has no plan for managing this type of stuff. As Mike said, you know, you start looking at these cheap supply of storage space. One avenue may be just to start dumping everything into one location as opposed to doing nothing. But as we've all found, you know, the cost of putting these plans into place, a retention program, a retrieval program, storage, everything is very expensive. But as Morgan Stanley would show you, it's also very expensive to do things incorrectly or not to have the data properly available. The tax bill, when it comes due, is going to be a pretty tough one to swallow. I think the best thing to do, in my opinion, whether you're a large company or small, is to have something in place that you can fall back on, even if it is just storing the data and hoping that you can find it at a later time. Doing nothing and having no plan in today's world, especially in litigation, isn't going to get you very far. As a law firm I used to know in New York, they had a little tagline used to say, ignorance is bliss, but it won't stand up in court of law. This is a good example. You can't expect almost any court today not to find it somewhat surprising that you have nothing in place. And perhaps they can look at it and say, well, you had nothing. But I would feel much better knowing for my own records, especially a corporation that's got Sarbanes-Oxley and other issues you have to worry about. Where is your documents? How have you stored them? What are you retaining? You got to have something in place, and sooner the better.
Cliff, when we first spoke about doing this event, you said you'd be happy to share your sense of what's happening on the business side to make this messy area of electronic records management even scarier for everyone. And I know we're planning to scare people in the last section, but help me understand what you think is getting scary about this area.
Sure. I think a couple, you know, not to make this, again, not to go back and turn this into a bleak discussion, because there certainly are capabilities, there are tools, and as Neil pointed out, there are ongoing technical investments and innovations to try to get a better handle on this and provide better tools for companies to do this. But in the meantime, some of that same technology is actually going to be working against us as well. We're looking at, in addition to the prolific growth of the amount of information that's being generated here, the fact that we're not working on a perfectly stable platform, most companies haven't really nailed the old world of traditionally created documents and correspondence. And in the meantime, we're tripping happily into the world of Web 2.0 and wikis and blogs and social software. And we're actually, literally, I'm getting pulled into conversations at some very large companies discussing the implications of doing business in Second Life. Virtually every industry has at least one leading company that's found its way into that environment to do business. And if I'm, you know, in the world where I have a conversation with an insurance agent in Second Life that's material to subsequent business activity or litigation, who owns that record? And how do we address that? So I think just as technology is trying to help resolve the historical situation, we're going to be creating some additional surprises going forward.
Neil, your company was a pioneer in implementing record management systems at Cisco, and I'd like to give everyone a cite to a really good article published in Law Technology News in October 2005. Actually, I don't have the site in front of me, but that's a lot of the site. But it went through, you know, the process and what your company found doing this. An AAIM survey revealed the primary obstacles facing end users in considering document and records technology in 2003 remains the same today in 2007. Selling management, managing change, and maintaining employee commitment. Do these issues seem relevant given your experience, and do you have any advice on overcoming them?
Well, this is a really hard question, and I think the comment that was just made before about blogs and wikis and sort of the new world is that these issues exist, but they are being joined by a whole sense of Web 2.0 and collaboration. I mean, the senior management and employee commitment and all those things is necessary, but probably not sufficient for success here. So as I was saying before, it starts off with senior management telling the world the company that this is something we're committed to, and here's how we're going to put the resources behind it to do it reasonably well. But it is a larger question about, I guess the hurdles are bigger because now you have all this collaboration, and the question that was just asked a minute ago is right on point by Cliff. But as I was saying, the tools to overcome these hurdles are going to be better. So it's a new set of challenges today than it was 4 years ago, and I say that because we had a senior executive who was giving a talk at MIT, and somebody at MIT said about Cisco, "Oh, you're that email company." And his reaction was to say, "Well, you know, we weren't responsible. We're a networking company. We weren't responsible for the use of email." And they said, "No, you're that big company that still uses email." And the point being that the forms of communication are changing much more quickly. And I think the younger folks are barely using email, and they're using MySpace and Facebook and the like. And so there are corporate examples of that as well, where our engineers are collaborating all over the place using all sorts of different technologies, and the question is how do you get your hands around those. So I think the issues are a little bit different, but as I was saying, at least there is a fair amount of research being done right now on how do you go about harnessing all this information and capturing it in a way that's defensible.
Jonathan and Cliff, first to Jonathan and Cliff if you want to add anything. Today you're both involved in designing and implementing solutions in this field. Jonathan, you do it from a consultative perspective, managing legal risks, and Cliff, you're working on the business people implementing solutions. What are you seeing in 2007 regarding these obstacles of selling management, managing change, and maintaining employee commitment, and any other obstacles you might encounter?
Carl, in terms of trying to get solutions out there that will work, I've got four on my list, and the first one is kind of an odd one, but it's true. We've seen it's infighting that there's been a creation of distrust between maybe the legal department and IT, or maybe in terms of IT not providing legal with what they wanted, or maybe legal has made onerous demands that turned out to be kind of stupid Chicken Little kind of demands on the IT folks. So there's kind of a distrust there that is really a barrier to getting holistic solutions out there. A second thing I've seen as far as problems is that the solution out there is an orphan. No one really wants to take ownership of finding a true policy that's going to work across an organization and fighting for the technology and process solutions you need. The third thing is a lack of understanding of the true total cost of ownership, understanding that you need to think about compliance from both the records management and the legal hold. When you're looking at any new application, how is it going to impact our ability to retain, destroy, and if necessary, preserve information? Do people have that understanding and awareness of what they need to do? And then the fourth thing is the education of employees, the people that are actually using the systems, using the applications, using the email, the messaging, existing on Second Life, wherever you want to be. What kind of education and training are you doing so that they understand their obligations? Because no matter what system we have here, at least for the next several years, no amount of automation is going to replace the fact that we have a certain element of human process interaction. And without the education piece, there are going to be failures. And what we're seeing is a real lack of education solutions, and not many companies are really dedicating the amount of money and resources necessary to train people and then have a follow-up compliance audit to make sure that training is sufficient and that it follows up on new applications.
Cliff, I'm not sure if you had anything to add to that or...
I guess maybe just to reaffirm what Jonathan just pointed out, that while sponsorship is difficult, trying to get the funding together, the challenge of having the business side, and maybe take IT a little out of the equation, have the business side working more closely with the legal side proactively to understand. There are a lot of good solutions out there that are actually in prime time and ready for deployment today. The ownership point that Jonathan brought up, it's not just the sponsorship and funding, but at the end of the day, who really owns this space is critical. And the people dimension, we cannot make this fully automated, but there is a pretty unreasonable burden we're asking of people to, first of all, understand the concept of what is a record, second, to care enough during the course of their day, and the worst part is, even the well-intentioned folks, to navigate 4,000 or 5,000 retention rules and hopefully pick the right one and have that be consistent is a real challenge. IBM's records management plan is 218 pages long, and we expect that all of our employees have read it and are in compliance with it. And that's maybe a little bit of a leap of faith.
I was going to say, just quickly, this is Michael, and records management plans and record series rarely are developed in the categorization that are useful from an e-discovery point of view when you end up drilling down to much more detail than they are set up in.
Yeah, Carl, that's the one disconnect here, the reality that you need to understand what laws and regulations govern your retention obligations, but then how do you translate that to something that an employee can actually follow through and do? And the point made that there are literally schedules out there across America where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of categories listed. It's just not manageable. So where is the marriage of this process to the technology? And anyone even thinking about how can you reduce this to something that employees can manage, some people say that an employee can really only manage a yes or no, retain or not retain. Others take a look at jury research and think that most people can handle maybe up to remembering seven different buckets. But getting far beyond that, they're not going to do it. That's the reality of what people have seen.
Hey, Carl, Cliff again. One quick point before we move on. We are still, again, with the trying to sprinkle a little sunshine into this whole discussion, we are working with companies that are finding ways to help address some of those things, even if it's just the front-end user adoption side. One simple example, for high visibility, high concern, high risk, either business activities or correspondent types or specific actors in certain roles in the business operations, if compliance and legal and regulatory can identify certain segments where a consistent type of document or some sort of artifact is a major concern, we can actually take this away from its native authoring format and use, for example, an eForms technology that has metadata in the back end. So the minute you've instantiated, I need to create this artifact, you don't have to declare, you don't have to map to the right rule. In the background, we already know it's declared, we know which rule. Once somebody in records management and legal figured out what rule attaches to it and whether there's state-specific designations, and we can pull that all up in the background, and we help the users not to have to go through some of those things. So again, there certainly are things we can do as long as we're proactive.